In some ways, it's quite a complex area to get into, so I've given you quite a full handout, and I hope that'll be helpful. You don't need to turn to it, but there's some stuff at the end that tries to outline some of the things we'll be thinking about God's sovereignty and providence and that tricky area of predestination. We're not really going to touch on predestination as such. We're going to think about God's wider providence. So how does he govern all things whilst we make meaningful decisions? But we will have lots of time for questions. So if you've got questions on the predestination thing, you can ask those and we might, you know, give a bit of time to that. But there's some stuff on there to help you. Hands up if you watched The Blue Planet 2. Yeah. Wasn't it amazing? I have to say, I've rarely watched something that has moved me more to praise from my sofa than Blue Planet 2. But one of the things that it did strike home to me about was just how little we know about our world. So I think at one point they said, we know more about the surface of Mars than we do what's at the bottom of the sea. And they once thought there was nothing down there, and actually now they've found there's like a jungle of life. And then you've got some quite surprising creatures that we weren't expecting. So Percy the Tuskfish, who showed a lot more ingenuity than people thought fish ever would, gets a cockle and breaks it open on a rock. And then you've got, I can't even read my writing, some kind of group fish that teamed up with the octopus. Do you remember that one? And working as a team in hunting and things. And I think thinking about the wonders of our creation is really helpful for our devotional life, I think, because it just reminds us, doesn't it, at the limits of our own knowledge. So one of the doctrines of God that I think is much forgotten nowadays is what we would call the doctrine of God's incomprehensibility. Doesn't mean he can't be known, because the incomprehensible God makes himself known in human history and the Bible and in Jesus. But it does touch on the fact that though we can know God truly, how arrogant to think we could ever know him fully. And so when it comes to thinking about some of these big questions, as it does with all sorts of questions, we've got to realize that we come humbly before the word of God. Well, actually, there's going to be a limit to our knowledge. We're all shaped by our however many years. We're all shaped by our culture. We're all shaped just by the limits of our abilities as human beings. So God willing, we're going to try and find some avenues of thought that the Bible gives us on this tricky area of God's sovereignty and human responsibility. But if you go away thinking, well, I haven't quite tied it all up, well, that's a good thing, because I don't think we can ever think we've tied everything up with God. I remember thinking in my sort of late 20s, after being converted a couple of years, that I thought I'd about nailed it. And now I understood everything that was to understand. And of course, the longer you go on as a Christian, the more you realize you don't, which is good for the soul. So we want to come with humility. We're thinking about God's sovereignty. Once I was teaching on this and someone came up to me at the end and said, I don't know what sovereignty means. So it's worth us defining that, isn't it? So we know our queen is our sovereign. Sovereignty is all about rule. We might say the dominion and power and authority of a particular ruler. And when it comes to God's sovereignty, we talk about its sphere being a universal one. God is sovereign. He rules over everything that there is, the whole universe, however big it is, or even infinite. And we talk not just about sphere, we talk about degree as well. So God's sovereignty is absolute. There is no one above him. He has absolute sovereignty over everything. And when we look at the Bible, and this is what we're going to be doing in the coming minutes, we see that there's a couple of different ways we think about God's sovereignty expressed within space-time history. He expresses his sovereignty over the whole creation. So I don't know if it's ever occurred to you, but Genesis chapter 1 immediately presents us with a king. Because kings speak and things obey. So God immediately is the creator king who speaks and the creation obeys him. Light appears. You know, the waters separate. Land, vegetation, animals, and people. So God commands creation He expresses his rule as creator king by commanding creation, and it obeys. But he also seems to command creatures too. And at least in terms of human beings, they're supposed to obey, but sometimes don't. The strange thing we're trying to deal with today is the fact that there is a sense in which even their not obeying is somehow under God's rule over all things, if that makes sense. So he is sovereign over the free decisions of human beings. Well, let's begin with this idea of God as sovereign over the creation. The word providence, really, as I've put it there, helps us to understand God sustaining and directing all things. Let's turn, and we're going to look at a few scriptures along the way, just to make sure we're engrossing ourselves in the word. Let's turn to Job chapter 37, which is such a grand portrait, isn't it, of the sovereign God. Job chapter 37. Now, you'll know that Job's comforters, so-called, don't always get things right, but nevertheless, there's a lot about what they say that resonates and accords with what we find in the wider Bible. And from Job 37, 5 to 13, we see something of God's sovereignty over the natural world. Job 37, verse 5. God's voice thunders in marvelous ways. He does great things beyond our understanding. He says to the snow, "Fall on the earth," and to the rain shower, "Be a mighty downpour," so that everyone he has made may know his work. He stops all people from their labor. The animals take cover. They remain in their dens. The tempest comes out from its chamber, the cold from the driving winds. The breath of God produces ice, and the broad waters become frozen. He loads the clouds with moisture. He scatters his lightning through them. At his direction, they swirl around over the face of the whole earth to do whatever he commands them. He brings the clouds to punish people or to water his earth and show his love. Now, can you see what's being assumed about the sovereign God there? The things we take for granted, you know, snow and rain and wind and the like, they're not operating apart from him. And it's using human language to talk about it, but it's so governed by him, it's like he gives commands and the elements respond, just as in creation. So I guess we see two things here, and they're drawn out particularly in verses 12 and 13. First, the creation does what God commands in every respect. And the second, he commands it with purpose. Can you see that? Verse 13, the Lord brings the clouds to punish people or to water his earth and show his love. In other words, God is intentional in what he commands within the creation. No doubt there's other reasons as well, but here we see that what he does with the elements can both punish and bless. Of course, water comes down and gives food in God's kindness that we benefit from. So there he commands the natural processes in blessing and grace towards everyone, even those who hate him. Yet there are times when he might bring some kind of disaster upon someone or a people group. Think of the Egyptians with the plagues in such a way that brings judgment. So the point is that God governs everything. He commands even these everyday natural processes with intent. Well, just to get our brains going a bit, why not just turn to the person next to you and try and answer the question in that box there. You don't need to look up Psalm 104. Just think about the flood narrative that we know so well. And just jot down, if you like, or mention to one another the stated and implied aspects of the creation that God must have controlled in bringing about the flood and in keeping his promise never to flood the world again. So just chat to the person next to you and try and just mention to one another what are the different things that are implied under God's control just by that narrative. Okay, I'm sure that's enough. So just give me some answers. What are some of the aspects of creation that God must be controlling to bring about the flood or to keep this world from being flooded again in the same way? Just mention some things.
Rain,
thank you. So rain, and for quite a long time, or holding it back. What else? The rainbow in the sky, thank you, with all the light that's involved in that and all that has to come together at the same time. Just the time when God is making his promise and wanting to signify it. What else?
Animals,
that's right. The Lord leads them to the ark, doesn't he, somehow? And if we find that fantastical, it's not hard to think about it when you consider that the animals have this amazing navigation system, God-given, through which they go to the same place every year, you know. But the Lord leads them to the ark. What else? Sorry? Yeah, thank you. So the water cycle itself, brilliant. The water cycle, how heat works on water and how that be used at exactly the right time. Anything else? So there's a sense in which he's commanding the human beings in that as well. And of course, he's keeping wood floating as well, isn't he? So that they're saved. Yep. Yeah, timing. Yeah. And timing's a key thing in some of the creation miracles, isn't it? That, you know, scholars will tell us, oh, well, we can work out why that happens, you know, why quail fall down in the desert. But the point is, yeah, but they do it exactly the time when the people are petitioning the Lord. Anything else? Yeah, that's helpful, actually. So the idea of Babel limiting the evil that human beings can do. I'm not sure I'd want to say that's the reason the world's never flooded again. I think the reason given for the world never flooding again is that God promises that it won't. Because he was gracious. And when Noah came off the flood and made a sacrifice that was recognizing his own sin, God in his kindness promised to the benefit of Noah and all his descendants and all the animals that he would keep this world going, ultimately so that Jesus could come. But we're not going to get distracted on that because I can feel us almost there. Any other things that God commands in the flood that he keeps going?
But he
brought yeah, brought the vegetation back and things like that. Yeah. 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 So you've also got the floodgates of the deep, some think the earth opening and something coming out, or perhaps some kind of great tsunami-like engulfment from elsewhere. But the point for us is simply not to get all tied up in the flood. The point of us is to realise just how much control and sovereignty God is displaying in everything, just through the everyday natural processes. Turn with me, would you, to Hebrews chapter 1. Hebrews chapter 1. And as we go, what theologians do is they keep trying to just make distinctions and clarifications to help sort of tease out some of these complicated ideas. So I'm just going to follow them in trying to do that. And so there's three words that help us understand something of this way God controls, directs everything that happens. The first is the idea of him preserving everything that's there, keeping it going. Have a look down at Hebrews 1 and verse 3. It's a striking verse. We read that the Son of God is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. I wonder if that's ever occurred to you, that the reason that you're sitting here and breathing that breath and that one too, is because the Son of God is sustaining all your bodily processes, as well as everything that's around us, by his powerful creative word, the word through which everything has been made. So when we think about God's sovereignty, we're not to think about God somehow removed from the creation, and every now and again rolling his sleeves up and suddenly getting involved. God is preserving, keeping everything together constantly. Second is the idea of concurrence. And we don't need to turn back to Job 37 because we've read about this already. But in doing that, God works through the distinctive properties of everything that he's made. So nothing is independent of God, but God is working through the processes that he's set up. He's causing heat to keep evaporating water so that it makes rain, and rain comes in his good time as other processes kick in. And what that means is that our weather people and our scientists can observe what goes on, and they can come up with predictions and explanations for it all. But that doesn't remove God from the picture, for he is the one who sustains it all and is working through those processes that he's created to do what he's doing. Please. Let's hold that question, because it's a very obvious one, and it's right for you to ask it. And at the end, we're going to come to think about how all this works around ideas of suffering and evil. So we're going to end up there. So what that means for us is that every blessing that we enjoy, you know, the landscape, the flower, the pet, whatever it might be, is something that, you know, is a great gift from God to us, that he is keeping going and working in and with. It helps us to understand miracles. We'll think about this a bit later on, but miracles aren't God, again, suddenly getting involved, because actually he's involved in everything, and he's directing it just as he pleases. All that a miracle is God involving himself in a way that's not the norm for how he does things. He has normal ways of doing things, because that's a blessing to us. The fact that we can rely on the weather forecast, and we can rely to some degree on crops growing and our breath continuing is a blessing to us, isn't it? Because it means we can live an ordered life. But God could do things in a very random way if he so chose, because he does everything. The third idea is one of governance. And that is that bound up with all this, we have to acknowledge, as Ephesians 1 verse 11 puts it, that therefore God works all things according to his faultless purpose. And again, I think we struggle with this because often we misunderstand God's sort of involvement. We think that God's sort of standing behind the creation and he only sort of gets involved at key points. But when you understand that the Son of God is preserving everything that happens and actually concurring with the different processes and things, then we have to say that everything has been worked out according to God's purpose, because nothing is happening that isn't somehow involving him. Do you see? There is no process that doesn't have the Son of God preserving it and concurring with it in some way. You see? So you can't possibly say that things aren't all directed according to God's purpose, because that makes no sense of him having to do everything, keep everything going. Perhaps every illustration falls down, but, you know, if I'm teaching my child to ride her bike, you know, I'm running along with her like that. And what's different is that in the end she's going to go it alone, but that's not like that with God. He's with us all the way. He's constantly there. We'll think a little bit about the fact that he sometimes, you know, he allows us to turn one way or the other, or he might give us a little nudge so we turn the other way, but he's there constantly in all things. Some distinctions, though. We need to distinguish here between God's direct causation in what happens. So there are some things where he's the sole cause. So when he speaks and creation comes from nothing, there's no other process that God's kind of using in that, is there? You know, this is creation ex nihilo, from nothing. Or when someone's raised from the dead, it seems that God is much more directly involved in that. There isn't a normal, everyday bodily process that reconstitutes and where matter is transformed into a heavenly manner. God is doing something in a direct sense. But there's also, and we're already seeing this, indirect ways in which God causes things. So he uses what theologians call means, or secondary causes. So it's right to say the reason it rained today is because of evaporation and condensation, all this kind of stuff. But it's also right to say the reason it rained today is because God sent rain. He is the first and ultimate cause to that. But the process of evaporation that he concurs with and has put in place is a secondary cause, do you see? It's quite an important distinction. Because again, when we start to think about human decisions, we can say God might be an ultimate and first cause behind a human decision and order of events, but that doesn't mean that we're not involved in that too, in our own responsible choices as a secondary manner. But we'll hold that for the time being. And here we might distinguish then between ordinary and extraordinary works of God as well. So an ordinary work of God is that he acts according to his usual appointed order. And we would call these laws of science. So things work in an observable way, thankfully, so we can conduct our lives. But that's only because God has chosen in his kindness towards us that that's how things are going to be. And it helps us. But sometimes he acts in a way that we would call extraordinary, and we give that term miracle. It's not that he suddenly gets involved because he's involved in everything, but at that time, for his own purposes, he works in an extraordinary way, perhaps to make us more aware that he's there and he's doing something, you see? A.A. Hodge, who's actually quite a renowned and very clear-minded theologian, he wrote over 100 years ago, that God has decreed, which is a sort of divine command, kingly command, he's decreed ends as well as means, causes as well as effects, conditions and instrumentalities as well as the events which depend upon them. In other words, the Bible talks about God sort of commanding everything to be as it is, and then he puts that into effect as he preserves it and concurs with it and directs it. Yeah? I hope I'm not overstating the point, but it's quite important for us. So with those distinctions in mind, let's start moving from the creation to thinking about us as creatures and how God involves himself in our lives. Let's turn to Genesis chapter 45. So you know the story. If you haven't read the book, you've been to the show, you know, way, way back many centuries ago, not long after the Bible began, Jacob lived in the land of Canaan. And he wasn't a fine example of a family man. So he was a very dysfunctional family, bit of a mess. The 11 brothers plot to murder Joseph. Then Reuben intervenes. So they put him in the pit and then they sell him and he gets taken to Egypt. In Egypt, he finds himself in the house of Potiphar, and Potiphar is blessed because Joseph, one of Abraham's descendants, is with him. But then his wife takes a fancy to Joseph. Joseph, in a godly way, runs away, but she accuses him anyway, so he ends up in prison for 2 years. In prison for 2 years, he interprets the dream of the cupbearer and the baker. Both dreams come true. One dies, the other goes back to Pharaoh. And later, when Pharaoh has his own dream, speaks of Joseph, and Joseph interprets Pharaoh's dream, that God is going to send a famine. Well, he's going to send 7 years of plenty and then 7 years of famine. And Joseph advises stock up. And by that means, it's important to realize this, within four generations of God plucking Abraham out from nowhere and telling this barren man and his barren wife that you're going to become a great nation that's going to bring blessing to the whole earth. In four generations, son, grandson, great-grandson is the most important man but Pharaoh in the known world. And he's dispensing God's blessing to the whole world. That's our God. And that's how able he is to control all things. And we get a bit of a comment on that from Joseph here in Genesis 45. Because his brothers, when they realize that this princely man is actually Joseph who they plotted against, they're rightly fearful. Let's read from verses 4 to 11. Let's read from verse 3. Joseph said to his brothers, I'm Joseph. Is my father still living? But his brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. Then Joseph said to his brothers, come close to me. When they'd done so, he said, I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now there have been famine in the land, and for the next 5 years there will be no ploughing or and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by great deliverance. So then it was not you who sent me here, but God. He made me father to Pharaoh, lord of his entire household, and ruler of all Egypt. Now hurry back to my father and say to him, this is what your son Joseph says, God has made me lord over all Egypt. Come down to me and don't delay. Well, just to clarify this, if you turn over to chapter 50, and verse 18, a similar thing happens again after Joseph's father, Jacob's died, and the brothers are now fearful with dad dead. Joseph's going to turn against them. And he says, chapter 50, verse 19, don't be afraid, am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So you've got some questions on your handout. Again, chat with the person next to you. How does Joseph explain his brother's actions? Their evil actions, let's add, murder, plotting, slavery. Why did God do what he did, according to Joseph? And again, this time, list the stated and implied decisions of human beings God would have governed to get Joseph to the position that he did. All right? Make sense? Chat to the person next to you for a few moments. Okay, let's stop there. So again, if you feel free to give me some answers. So first of all, how does Joseph explain his brother's actions in these particular bits? So God's behind it, isn't he? So they sent Joseph to Egypt by selling him to the raiders, but God sent Joseph to Egypt. They intended all this, but God intended it as well. So what the secondary agents are carrying out, his brothers, God is the ultimate cause behind it, you see? The two are going on together somehow. And why is God doing it according to what you saw? Yeah. Yeah. So God is intending their evil actions for good reasons. So somehow, you know, he's having them making their wicked decisions for which he would call them to account, and they will learn and grow. And the brothers are learning a lot through all this. But God is doing something good in it all. Because God knows that for whatever reasons, a famine's going to come. And from what we've learned, God's going to bring a famine. And he wants to display his purposes in raising up Abraham to Isaac to Jacob to Joseph, just is it three or four generations, you know, up to that point of precedence, to show how able he is to fulfill his promises, to show that he cares for his people Israel and indeed the wider world. He wants to do all that, and he's using this means to do it. More than that, if you think really hard about the story, he wants to actually govern that whole period of history, including the most powerful nation on earth at the time, in such a way that's going to lay a sort of pattern in history of what he's going to do through Jesus. Because Jesus and Joseph are quite similar in what they experience. Joseph is betrayed by his brothers. Jesus is unjustly accused. Jesus suffers because he's unjustly accused. And like Joseph, is raised up to the highest place from which he dispenses his life to the world. So God is even governing that whole period of history so that we might learn something about his son. And the problem we get when we come to God's sovereignty and human responsibility is just our view of God is much too small. He's just so much bigger, which helps us when we can't fully tie it all down. But we've got to stand in awe at this God who can govern all things, even the evil decisions of human beings, for good ends. And we'll think about how he does that supremely in Jesus later. What are sort of stated and implied decisions of human beings then that God would have governed in doing this with Joseph? So let's just shout up some of the things that he must have been somehow bringing about, governing, directing. What sort of things?
He would have, with Jacob, the way that he would govern the way that Jacob would behave towards Joseph.
Thank you. Yeah. So thank you. So the favoritism of Jacob towards his son that led to jealousy, perhaps Joseph's, there's a hint of him being a little bit arrogant in talking about his dreams to them. So that kind of stuff, which leads them to seek to murder and then sell him. What else?
Must have been fairly attractive as a man.
Yep. So ladies' comment. That's right. So God even forming the handsome Joseph, so an enticement to Pharaoh's wife. What else? I'd never thought about that one, so thanks for that. Yeah. So Reuben's sudden thinking, I'm going to intervene. Slave traders come by at just that time. Somehow, yeah. Somehow their evil intent was under his control. Anything else? Who would buy him? That's right. And in Egypt, you mean Potiphar? Yeah. So again, the point is just like with creation, so much God must have governed. Feelings, circumstances, timings, inclinations, all that kind of stuff under God's hand in some way, bringing about his purposes. Now, we don't have time to tease all this out. I've listed on your handout with Bible verses, so you can look them up at home if you'd like to, just the many things the Bible tells us that God governs. Where people settle and live, the rise and fall of nations, the decisions of kings, the heart of every individual, every day of our lives, every step we take, the children we have, every good we experience, every spiritual benefit we receive, every act of faithfulness we commit, natural and human effort in bringing us food, yet also whether we succeed or whether we fail, the calamities we face, the deception amongst his people, the hardness of hearts against him, our evil deeds, the work of Satan and even demons, all somehow under the sovereign governance of God. So let's try and think this out a little bit in terms of this thing of God's sovereignty and human responsibility. David is a great place to base this discussion. Look at Psalm 139 with me, if you would. Now, if you're a kind of scholar of Psalms, you can talk to me afterwards. I want to argue the case that when we read a Psalm of David, it is of David rather than just according to a sort of Davidic style. And Psalm 139 from verse 13. Look how David describes his life. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. And then in reflection, he turns to praise. How else could you respond? But just note what we're being told here. That's very similar to what we've just learnt with Joseph. God has ordained everything for David. So when, you know, the secondary cause of the processes of, you know, gestation and development in the womb and all that kind of stuff is going on, God is concurring with it, for the Son of God is preserving all that. God's there involved in it so that it could also be God knitting David together. And then once born, well, look how his whole life is described in verse 16. How many of David's days were ordained for him before they came to be? Well, all of them. So much so, and it's the language of poetry, that it's like they were all written in a book, scripted. This is how you're going to be. Now, think about David for a moment. Much of that was fantastic, wasn't it? You know, he was the one that trusted God to defeat Goliath, didn't even need his armor. He was the one that held back from killing Saul when he could have taken a slice at him. That was all ordained by God. But what else did David get up to? His lusting at Bathsheba, his adultery with her, his murdering of her husband. Terrible acts. For which David himself is rebuked and taken to task for, yet somehow also ordained as if in a book. What are we to make of this? Well, again, some more distinctions for us. We're going to have time for questions, so do store them up. First, we need to distinguish when it comes to God's providence between his direction of impersonal agents and his direction of what we might call free decision-making agents. So he directs impersonal things, in a very direct way. Plants, grass, whatever it might be. We don't have any problem with that, do we? God causing it to grow just as it grows. Fine. And with that, and we can recognize it as a secondary cause of all the pollination and growth and stuff going on as well. But the scriptures themselves portray it slightly differently when we think about free agents, decision-making agents. You see, there, it's slightly more nuanced. So we would be wrong to understand how God ordains all of David's life in a sort of deterministic way in which he's not responsible for the decisions that he makes, like a puppet on strings. Because that's not how the Bible portrays it at all. Remember, God is bigger than we think. So God is so big that at one and the same time he can direct everything that happens in someone's life, but in a way that ensures that they are still responsible for their decisions. And the three words that try and express that is God prompting endeavors or permitting endeavors or containing them. Each one of those three words carefully protects human responsibility. So, for example, in 2 Samuel 24, with David, we learn that God incites David to take a census, for which in the end, David is judged for his pride. So God has brought it about by inciting David, but David is accountable for doing it. In fact, in another book, we learn that God used Satan to bring that about. So the language of inciting is the language of God so governing things that he causes the human being to engage with reality in such a way that it draws out from them a decision that is one they are choosing to do of themselves, but is at the same time the one that God wants them to do. Can you grasp that? We'll use an illustration in a moment. Again, the idea of permitting. So with Satan, very famously in the book of Job, Satan wants to go at Job, and God permits him to do so. So there you've got the idea that even the most evil of beings is still subject to God and to God's rule. And God allows that free choice, if you like, in that case, but it's not apart from God's rule. God is somehow, if you like, allowing it, but with certain limits in Job's case. Which takes us to the third word, the idea of containing. So sometimes God contains a decision. So Satan wants to attack Job, but God says, yes, but you, in the initial sense at least, you mustn't harm him. So there, Satan is acting of his own will against Job, but he can't do anything that God hasn't allowed him to do, so he's contained in what he's able to do. So the point for us is quite simply that we understand that God somehow preserves, keeps everything going, he concurs with everything that happens, but when it comes to his engagement with what we might call free, although the word needs definition, agents, we've got to understand that there is nuance to it. Another couple of distinctions are between God's moral will and God's sovereign will. So when we talk about the will of God, we need to understand that with nuance as well. So God's moral will is what should be. God's moral will for King David was that he doesn't murder Uriah and commit adultery with Bathsheba. That's what should be. And God wanted that because that would please him. But God's sovereign will is what shall be as he governs all things. And we've seen that he had ordained for David even before he was born that nevertheless, in God's purposes, David would commit adultery and murder Uriah. And what that helps us understand is that sometimes when we understand this thing of the will of God, God wills things in his sovereign will that are against his moral will for his own purposes. As one writer puts it there, God is often pleased to ordain his own displeasure. Now, this illustration is very limited, but let me try it on you. I've got a daughter called Esme, and some of you know her. So it's always a bit difficult, isn't it, when you're using your kids, but she's not here. And like most children, Esme is quite predictable. I know at this age that she will respond in certain ways to certain things. So, you know, she's got a mobile phone, and we know that that is one of the most deterministic things that there is, a mobile phone. So I know that if I say, darling, turn off your phone, she won't do it the first time. I know her so well that I could guarantee you that she won't do it the first time, except if I put some other things in places that would be an alternative to that. So perhaps I want to, you know, it's been hard enough over the mobile phone thing and technology and stuff, and I think we've got to do that thing when we just deal with this. So I think, okay, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask her to turn off her phone, knowing that she's not going to, so that it provokes an instance where I can discipline her. So in I come. Darling, turn off your phone. Darling, turn off your phone. Darling, are you listening to me? Can you turn off your phone? Okay, so discipline comes. And, you know, I take the phone away and say, okay, you're not using your phone for 2 days. We've got to deal with this, and I'm going to put screen time app on. Big plug, it's a great app. So I can control it from my phone, which is quite fun. You can suddenly press pause from downstairs and it pauses upstairs. But the point is that even at the level of human relationships, we can know people well enough, can't we, that we can determine, ordain a decision that they make. And sometimes we might ordain something that is a wrong decision, an act of disobedience, for good ends. So as I do that, you know, Esme's going to say, that's unfair, Dad. You knew I'd do that. Well, is it unfair? Well, no, it's not. Is she responsible? Well, yes, she is. It was her own will that decided to disobey me. But I, knowing the disobedience of her will, brought about a situation where she would exercise it that way. Because I wanted to bring something good out of it, which was to discipline her, you see. Now, you know, it's much tighter with God. He's governing everything intimately. But at least we can start to see, can't we, how we might ordain evil acts for good ends. And God, who knows everything, every little part of us, because he's knit us together in the womb, known us before the creation of the world, how able is he to bring everything together in such a wonderful matrix of reality that everyone is doing what they are choosing to do of their own wills, but at the same time what God has somehow sovereignly determined. Have a look down at Proverbs 21, verse 1 there. I found this a very helpful kind of takeaway verse to help me on this. It simply says, in the Lord's hand, the king's heart is a stream of water that he channels towards all who please him. Now, I did a civil engineering degree. I loved hydraulics. Maybe that's why I get drawn to this verse. But just have a look at that. Meditate on it. Chew it over. In the Lord's hand, the king's heart is a stream of water that he channels, that is, God channels, towards all who please him. Now, just think about that for a moment. In what ways, even if you're not a civil engineer, you can get this. In what ways might we channel water? What might we do in channeling water? Sorry? That might be what we're doing with it, but what might we actually do to channel water? That's the illustration here. So we're going to dig a ditch. All right. What else? Sorry? But we might have a dam there to control it, control the water going in. So we get some water into the channel. Oh, what are we going to do then? Is the channel, you know, the channel's flowing that way, and we think, well, hang on a minute, reservoir's down there. So what are we going to do? Direct it down there. We might build up some other walls here. We might turn it this way and then this way as well. It might be coming up here, so we'll put a dam there to control it for a little bit before we put it down this way. Now, let me ask this question, though. Is the water running freely? Well, it is, isn't it? It's running according to the properties of water, isn't it? But what's happening is that you're channeling it and you're directing it one way or another, with your wisdom and ingenuity. Now, it's a proverb. It's not supposed to be teaching us tight doctrine, but I find something quite helpful in that God-given illustration. The fact is that when we talk about human freedom, and we can have questions on this later if you want, we assume human freedom means I'm always free to do whatever I want, like one thing or another. No one can really predict that. So at every moment, you know, I could stand like this or I could turn on my head and stand on my head instead. But that sort of kind of unconstrained freedom, I'd want to suggest to you no one has. Because we're affected by all sorts of things, aren't we? You know, I'm affected by the fact that, A, I know that my back wouldn't be up to it, and Mark's been a good example to me of being careful about my back, and B, I know that I'm just not enough of a fool for Christ to suddenly stand on my head to make a point. So I know that I'm not going to do that. So we can't live as if we really can choose, you know, A or B constantly. Lots of things govern the decisions we make, even how well we've slept and what we've eaten. Thanks be to God that he is ultimately governing it, so we're not just subject to all the random molecules, which is a sort of secularist view of determination, which is really determinist. Now, what freedom is, if we want to use that word, is it means that when I'm acting, it's not that I can just suddenly do one thing and then you can't predict I could do another thing. It's that whenever I'm acting, I'm doing what I want to do. So I know, and you know, that I'm not going to stand on my head. But that's a free choice of mine. I'm not free because I'm not going to stand on my head. I'm just choosing of my own will not to. I'm always doing what I want to do. And so it is with God governing of human decisions. Humans are always, God ensures everything happens in such a way that people are always doing what they want to do, but what they want to do is also what he has brought about by his governance of every single circumstance within and without. Do you see? So like the water is always acting freely according to its own nature, and I am as well. I'm acting freely according to my nature, and that nature might be to do what is good or to do what is evil. Now, I will be responsible for that because that's what I want. But God is with me and Esme is well able to put me in all sorts of circumstances where I'm acting according to that want, that freedom, in a way that he knows I will act, and therefore he is directing. Sometimes, as we've seen, prompting me to act in a certain way, sometimes, in some sense, permitting, allowing things to go, and sometimes containing, keeping me from doing worse. And I think those words, to do justice to them, just mean that we can't think of God in that sort of very tight way. Somehow they allow us to think about God governing everything, yes, but in a way that does justice to human freedom, human responsibility. So let me just read out this paragraph at the bottom, and then we're going to go through a final thing, and I'll take some questions. And I've got an hour and a quarter, which is great because I'm going to need it. Let me read you at the bottom here. Biblically, then, freedom is not the ability to act. Or is this the next page for you? Freedom is not the ability to act in a way that is independent of anything else. Our decisions are quite obviously determined by all sorts of factors. Rather, whatever influences may move us to act as we do, freedom is the ability to do what we want. It's the freedom that God ensures while also utilizing it, so that our free choices are those he has ordained and brought to pass by his governance of whatever may influence us, whether externally or internally. We do not act autonomously, we act willingly. And A.A. Hodge I find really helpful on this. He writes, the scriptures attribute all that is good in man to God. These, quote, he works in us both to will and to do as of his good pleasure. All the sins which men commit, the scriptures attribute wholly to the man himself. Yet God's permissive decree, that kingly sovereign word again, does truly determine the certain futurition of the act, because God, knowing certainly that the man in question would in the given circumstances so act, did place that very man in precisely those circumstances that he should so act. But in neither case, whether in working the good in us or in placing us where we will certainly do the wrong, does God in executing his purpose ever violate or restrict the perfect freedom of the agent? Now that's as technical, theological as we're going to get. So if you're feeling, oh, I'm not sure about that, go and read it a few times at home over a strong coffee. But let's ground this. We're going to think a little bit about the difficulties we have with this in a moment. But why is this good? Why should we go away tonight thrilled at this kind of stretching, weighty truth we've been thinking about. Why is this such good news to learn this? Can anyone give me some reasons? Well, that depends. So it's good in the sense that it upholds real responsibility. In that sense, yes. And therefore, it is a good that we're not just subject to random kind of molecules and the determinism of the world around us. Yes, thank you. It's a good point. Why else is it good? We can't get outside God's rule and protection. So some talk about this doctrine with God rather like a chess master. So we kind of move our piece one way and God quickly rearranges things to sort of outwit us, which actually is a terrible kind of concept, isn't it? Because firstly, it means that people are doing things that are aside from God's purpose. So every evil act then becomes something that, he's been outwitted on. Second, it kind of diminishes God because he's running around trying to kind of, deal with that. But thirdly, you can't be sure then that he's not going to be outwitted in the end. That he might be a grandmaster that fails in the game of chess, But of course, the Bible predicts in advance it all. God is governing it all. Why else could it be good? Can anyone think of other reasons? Thank you. Yeah. So I'm really aware giving this talk tonight that, this kind of stuff actually could be quite painful. So you think back to a painful divorce or a struggle with cancer or a lost loved one, or you switch on the news tonight and you see, the most appalling acts going on in Syria. And of course, we're going to try and deal with that a little bit in a minute. You think, well, hang on, how could God possibly be provoking, permitting, or constraining that? Why didn't he just get rid of all that? And to some extent, the answer is, well, we don't really know. But that's not to mean that he's not still preserving and concurring and involved in it. But why that is good news is because the corollary of that is that even that is somehow working out towards God's good purposes. And this is where I think, we come back to the blue planet, because we can't see it all. We think, surely there is no good purpose that can come out of that. It's like the bottom of the sea that's barren and dead. Nothing good can come out of war. But of course, our understanding is limited. I trust on the basis of the scriptures that actually in the resurrection, when we see God face to face, we'll suddenly find out that, like on the blue planet, what we assumed was barren all along is filled with life. Because God has somehow been working good from it. Perhaps the amount of Muslims we're hearing coming to faith at the moment in the Middle East is one of those things. But here we trust, don't we, this God that we see in Jesus, who's so much bigger than we can grasp, but we're comforted that even the bad is somehow working for good. Back in that Joseph narrative, one of the things that people miss is Judah. At the beginning, Judah is kind of the lead antagonist against Joseph. Judah's the one who sins with Tamar. He's the kind of least of the brothers. At the end, all that stuff about silver cups and sacks and things like that is all about Joseph trying to test the brothers to see how they're going to do if this time the younger brother comes under threat, Benjamin. He sets Benjamin up, do you remember? And he wants to put him in prison. Guess which brother it is that says, please take me instead of Benjamin. Judah. Because through all that time, God has been sanctifying Judah through his guilt and struggle over what that evil act he did to become the kind of man that God wants to head up the tribe of Judah. And when Jacob gives his blessing over Judah, he says of Judah, the scepter won't depart from you until the one to whom the obedience of the nations come. Judah is going to be the man through whom the Christ arrives. So we've just got to remember that though we look at evil and suffering in the world and it seems all barren, like our assumptions about the pit of the ocean, our knowledge of God is so limited that we will find out in the end that it's something that's brought about great life. And that takes us to our final point, God's sovereignty in human evil. John Frame has written, a really helpful outlining of how the Bible deals with this issue of how there could be a sovereign God whilst evil and suffering occur. He's rightly critical of the argument very often we come up with, and I remember myself as a new Christian coming up with this. where we say something like, well, the reason these things occur is because God has to let us be free, otherwise we'd be robots. And therefore, he allows us to do these awful things because he wants meaningful relationships and meaningful decisions and stuff. No doubt many of us have often said that. The problem with that is that it's like saying, okay, I've got a rabid dog, and for the sake of letting the dog, you know, express itself, I'm going to let it off the leash. You know, that's irresponsible, isn't it? It's also a problem because when we look at the new creation, there we're looking forward to a humanity where none of us are going to ever choose to do evil. So clearly, God doesn't have to allow evil. He's going to bring us about into a world where every one of us will always choose what is right by the Holy Spirit. So that kind of free will defense of suffering and evil doesn't work. The Bible's presentation is that God does govern everything. Yes, he utilizes our responsible decisions, but we're not to do other than what he has determined. So what does Frame say? Well, he gives us five pointers, and really they're just things to help us work this one through. He says, we find in Scripture not a philosophical solution to the problem, but a great reassurance, a powerful motivation to keep trusting and obeying despite all the wickedness of the world. And what he's saying is, look, what you don't find in the Bible is a knockdown argument that kind of deals with all this. What you find in the Bible are good reasons to keep trusting God despite it. Okay? I think that's quite helpful and humble. First, and here Joseph, I think, is quite helpful for us. He says, look, what you don't find in the Bible is God doesn't defend himself on all this. So when people say, God, what about suffering and evil? He doesn't say, oh, I'm really sorry. Let me give you a sort of theological explanation for it. With Job, what does he do? He says, where were you? Where were you when I created the world, when I bring stars out or snow and rain and thunder? Where were you? He doesn't defend himself. He just raises our eyes to realize he's, as we've said, much bigger than we think. Second, he doesn't just not defend himself. He goes on the offensive and asserts always that he will do as he pleases. I will have mercy on whom I have mercy, and I will harden whom I want to harden. Now, if you feel uncomfortable with that, join the club. I do as well. And God doesn't hold back from saying that because it's more important that we realize our place before him, that he's the sovereign one. Third, as we've seen, nevertheless, he does reveal to us that he uses evil for good ends. We've seen that with Joseph. The evil that brothers intended, God intended for good, the saving of many lives. God, as the primary cause, acts through the secondary causes of human responsible decisions. Fourth, God has vindicated, that is, he has proved and upheld and displayed that he is both just and good throughout the scriptures and especially in the cross. This is what I say to people that are struggling pastorally. How could God be allowing this? The answer is, well, we don't really know. But you don't need to doubt that he is just and good. Look at Jesus. That's where we need to take people always, isn't it? Look at the cross. We know that God is just and good. He sent his son in love for this world, his son, to suffer hell itself for our redemption. And what do we see with the cross? Well, if you look up Acts 4, 27 and 28 at home, you will read that what Herod and Pilate did, God purposed. They did only what his plan and purpose had decided beforehand should happen. The greatest act of evil ever done by a human being, the crucifixion of the Son of God, was purposed and brought about by that very Son's loving Father for the sake of you and me. So we can't doubt God's justice and goodness. It's displayed so clearly in the person of Jesus and in the cross. And remember, Jesus is the one who can calm a storm with a word, yet chooses not to calm so many storms that we face. Fifth, all this, therefore, without giving us a knockdown answer to the problem of evil, gives us sufficient reasons to trust God whatever is faced. We may not see the greater good in our circumstances. And often people will say to me, well, I can't see what God's doing in it. And the answer is, well, you might never know until you get to glory, if then. But it doesn't mean he's not doing something good. He's given us sufficient reasons to trust him, whatever. And I've put in that box there some of the goods the Bible tells us God works through evil. Displaying grace and justice, bringing judgment, working redemption, shocking unbelievers to promote a change of heart, disciplining, that is, shaping believers, and shaping them into the likeness of Christ and vindicating his own character. There's lots of things God might be doing in the midst of suffering. A final illustration before we have a few minutes for questions. Parents, if your baby could talk and think in quite this way, what would that baby think as you take it, 3 months old, along to a man who they've never met before in a strange room, and you put that baby on that man's knee and he takes out a really long, sharp object and jabs it into that baby's arm, causing the baby to squeal and cry. What might your baby think? I thought you loved me, Mum or Dad. How cute, what on earth are you doing? That you who govern every aspect of my life, that you would put me through this incredible, wicked suffering. But you and I know the reason, don't you? We know that that suffering is intended for good, the immunization against all sorts of illnesses and diseases. And you and I know that when that baby becomes an adult, that baby will understand. That baby will not even remember, but will be thankful that you are willing even to cause the child to suffer for its own good. And again, in a very limited way, I think that's helpful for us. We are but children, yet on the day of Christ, we will see God face to face. And then the tapestry that we look at from underneath and look so messy and confused, we'll see from the other side, and then we'll see the wonderful pattern that's on it. So in conclusion, a number of things, just to tie it down there on your handouts. God has decreed all that comes to pass, ordaining everything that happens like a king. He does this in a way that ensures that we are free in the sense of having this freedom of spontaneity, that we're able to do what we want to do, but not something that's independent of any cause. And that means we live in what we might call a risk-free universe, so everything is somehow working out according to the faultless purpose of his will. Now, we've only actually got a few minutes quickly for some questions, but can I ask you just to please, if you've got questions that are there, I've tried to be as thorough as I can, and my answer is probably therefore going to be we've got as far as we can on this subject, but if you've got a question, please throw it up, or maybe something you want to clarify so that I'm not being misunderstood. Yeah, I think that's really helpful. I mean, I think there's a tension with all our knowledge of God, isn't there? That we're called to love God with all our heart, soul, mind and strength. So he wants us to stretch our faculties to the full, to understanding him so far as he's revealed himself. You know, the worshippers the Father seeks are those who worship him in spirit and in truth. But we have to do that humbly and submissively because he's the sovereign one. And where he hasn't chosen to reveal something, we have to take it on faith and trust it. You know, we haven't dealt with predestination, but obviously that, I think, is the extreme end of that. And there can, and we have to guard in ourselves right motive, don't we? There can be in us, in our readiness to be provoked at something that seems quite plain in the Bible, a sinful desire to say, unless I get it, it's outrageous and wrong. And at the same time, there can also be a sinful desire to sort of think, I've got to keep fighting. And because unless I can tie this one down, I'm sort of not going to believe, you know. So I think you're right. There has to be a place of humility and faith that's not blind, but it humbly says, I'm limited. This God is, I can't understand how my finger works, you know. This is the God who speaks and the universe comes into being. So helpful. Yeah, thank you. Any other questions or comments? I have to say, one of the things, interesting things with this is when that question does come up, sometimes it's worth just nudging back a little bit. I had a great conversation with one of the RS teachers at Warden Park. Do we have any RS teachers from Warden Park here? Okay. This was a few years ago. They might not have even been there then. And so it was interesting. They were talking about the curriculum when we were looking around for Esme, and she, I think it was, said, yeah, we do all the arguments, you know, against the existence of God, and we look at the Holocaust and how, you know, that the problem that is for the idea of God, because how could a loving God allow that kind of suffering and stuff like that? And I said, oh, great. Okay, it's great you do that. I said, do you also talk to him about the fact that if there is no God, why would we even care about something like the Holocaust? And she was just absolutely silent. She'd never even thought about it that way. And we have to push back on this and say, okay, there are some uncomfortable things that we deal with in suffering and evil, But the wonderful thing is we know that actually these things are under God, and there is purpose and there is redemption, there is change. But the alternative is a world where suffering and evil are utterly meaningless. They're just part of the process that's come into being, even part of ultimately a good that progresses us as human beings, as a race, because you've got rid of the disabled and you've got rid of the elderly. So we do need to push back on that and realize that we may not have all the answers about God's sovereignty and human responsibility, but it is a good thing that God governs all things. Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I mean, it just reminds us, doesn't it, we've got to be quite cautious about the way we talk about things with our non-Christian friends. I think we have to keep reminding people that we're very quick to say something's arrogant, and we can end up charging something that just is, you know. So if God is in control of everything, it's not arrogant for him to be in control of it. That's just the way it is and the way it needs to be. And you can start to unpack reasons why that must be that way and why it's such a good thing. But I think ultimately we want to always end up with Jesus, don't we? So how can we say it's an arrogant God who's ready to come into the world in the person of his son and suffer such acute death to rescue us from suffering and evil? So I think we have to just keep going back to the cross with this question. And, you know, you can say Jesus can calm storms, but he doesn't calm every storm. But look at how would we doubt his goodness and compassion? We can say that God hasn't just allowed suffering. He's done something decisively so people might escape it through faith in Christ. That resurrection delivers us from all this. You know, so I think we have to go there and almost park that question and just say, well, come with me and think a bit about what we see of God in the person of Jesus. And we don't see an arrogant, tyrannical God. We just see one who's much bigger. We need to finish, don't we?